students, they're going to be 5 minutes late.
Well, yeah, no. So usually I sit here waiting for the students, and then I have to have something to discuss while I'm waiting for the extra students to come in. So since we got one brave student here right now, well, okay, Uri, Gigging Pig or something. I want to look at. See, I just want to show off my pictures here. So, well, that's a new feature in my Droid phone. So, oh, we got more students coming in. So, everybody's coming. So come on in. Okay, Andrea, I know, is here. Okay, the trivia question before class starts is, do you know where this picture is taken from? And what's shown right here? Anybody from around here, drive around outside of the university, know where this is at? And what's this plume is right here? All right, people that haven't been here for 30 years. Okay, Leon, tell us where it is. Right. Well, I actually have it right here, right? East Grand Forks. So give you a hint, and you still... Yeah, see, I actually titled it. I could ask you what day it is. But it's a panoramic, and you see the clouds. And actually, it's pretty mile over the river, east side of the river on this day. And so we were talking yesterday a little bit about stability. So is the atmosphere very stable or unstable? So I got to take a vote here. How many people say stable? Okay, no one says unstable. So, all right, more people are still coming. So, all right, anybody know what this picture is from? Not my camera. It's a satellite image. I think it's a MODIS image. no, we don't get quite that high. So I like it because it shows the pyrocumulus cloud here, which is the clouds that form from the fires. You know, we had a lot of fires out west last summer and fall, so you can actually see the hot spots and the quote, and then you see the smoke and stuff all here. And it's close to North Dakota.
Is that MODIS?
Yeah, it's MODIS. And I'm not sure if it's Aqua Terra, but it's MODIS. So anybody know what this one is? Okay, considering the title of the talk. Oh yeah, Leon. No. Not that. It's aerosols. So it's probably taken, here's the hint of the 1 micrometer. So 1 micrometer is 10 to the minus how many meters? 10 to the minus 6. Oh, okay, we got one. And so these are the little aerosol particles that have been corrected on a filter. It's probably with a rectron scanning microscope image of them. So we can do that. So do we know who's all coming? Should I officially start, Mike? Or it's like a real crash. You know, it's 2 minutes after. And stuff. So, Anyway, today I want to talk to you about one of my favorite subjects, and it also goes along with my lecture yesterday. So if you're confused about stuff, hopefully I highlight some of the material that was background material for yesterday. So this would be in a physical meteorology course, general introduction to aerosols, and with emphasis on cloud condensation nuclei measurements. And I posted this online, so the open office, live office is online. So when I do my lectures, I make the students use open office or live office to view the presentations. Actually, they now in 2010, you can view it too, if you have Microsoft Office 2010. There's a PDF on there, and I'm also recording it for a couple of people that are not here that are interested in aerosols so that they can listen to it afterwards. So general introduction of aerosols and CCN. And if anybody's interested, these are a couple CCN counters. They are actually in the 423 lab, so hopefully I get you really excited and you want to come and physically where they are. I thought it was a little bit big to bring here, but stop by this afternoon and I can show you what they are. Importance of aerosols: they scatter and absorb radiation, so that means redirect radiation. This is the direct effect, climate effect that we'll talk about. The media for chemical reactions is important for like stratospheric ozone depletion. And the topic of today is the cloud condensation nuclei. They form nuclei with particles for water to condense on to form cloud droplets. And that's what I want to get to talking about today. So the objective is just to give you an introduction to atmospheric aerosols, some general things that you should remember, not just for the test, but 5-10 years later, next time you come. Explain how CCN counters are a subset of atmospheric aerosols, and illustrate how CCNs are measured, and what the concentrations are like in the atmosphere. So you have to have some numbers to keep in mind for all the different atmospheric phenomena. So you have to have some general numbers. So when someone tells you something, you know if it's high or low. So start out with a definition. Aerosols are suspended liquid or solid particles with a small settling velocity. That means gravity doesn't pull them down very fast. They stay in the air. There's turbulence that keeps them airborne. They have resonance times. Resonance times is what, Andrea? Yeah, it's the average time. It's really like, it's a time for two-thirds of them to be removed from the atmosphere. So they have resonance times of a few days to weeks. And of course, the resonance time increases the higher in the atmosphere the aerosols are. So they can be transported transcontinentally. And a lot of times, aerosols are referred to particles or particulate matter. A lot of people in chemistry refer to them as particulate matter, because they've measured them on filters. A lot of times they're particles. I use the term particles when they're not suspended. So a lot of times when they're in the instrument, they're termed a particle. When they're in the atmosphere and they're suspended, I use the term aerosol. And clouds, do you think clouds would be considered an aerosol? By my definition? All right. Mario, I can call on people because I know names. What do you think? So by my definition I just gave, would it be considered an aerosol? So technically they are, but we don't generally call them aerosols. So they're so special we call them clouds or cloud droplets. So technically they are, but no one really considers them that way. So, and here's a couple nice pictures of clouds taken on the second one on the citation. So one of the things about aerosols is What size are we talking about? We already know that 10 to the minus 6 is a micrometer, but, you know, that's small, isn't it? So, you know, we have a big order of magnitude. Typically, it's 5th meters, and a lot of times it is because it's a lot easier, 10 to the minus 0.001 to 10 micrometers, or nanometers. So a lot of times I'll flip between nanometers and micrometers when I talk about them. So 1 nanometer to 10,000 nanometers. So how small is this? So the question here is, what's the wavelength of visible light in any of these units? Okay, we got an answer. 0.4 to 0.7 microns. So that's the wavelength. That's how much the light goes up and down. So that's kind of in the middle here of the size range. So that's pretty small. You know, visible light is a small quantity. It's kind of so small we can't really visualize it. So what about something maybe a little bit bigger? What's the size of one of your hair strands? If you take one of the very thinnest strands of hair, how big is that about? That's something that you can see. It's small if you hold it up to the sunlight. Erica? Is it going to be bigger than visible light? Yeah, it's going to be bigger because you can actually see it because you see the scattering off. Just guess. Take one. You only have to be within a factor of 10. So that would be 50 microns. Let's see, no, that's 5 microns. 50 times 0.5. So 5 to 25, 25 microns. Probably bigger than that. Well, it's a little bit of a trick question because not everybody's human hairs are the same. So very fine, finest hairs you can find are about 10 microns. It's more like 100 microns for the thick hairs, okay? But that's something you can see. So, you know, the finest hairs are the size that we start, the upper limit of the aerosols. And then this gives you an idea of the magnitudes, the four orders of magnitudes that we're talking about in terms of the aerosol particles. So next is one concept that I think all students should have this picture in their heads when you talk about aerosols. This is the different modes that you have for the aerosols. And given on the x-axis is a particle size in micrometers. So here's your 10 microns and it actually goes up to 100. And here at about 0.003, which is kind of the starting point of aerosols, because before that you just have molecules clumped together. You have to have enough molecules being together to have some cohesion to actually start the particles, and that's where we really start to see them. Okay, and then what's on the y-axis? Why don't I have anything on the y-axis here? Anybody know? People should not make plots like this. This is kind of arbitrary. This is either the number concentration or the size of the area of the particle or the volume of the particle. But if you want, in terms of this, we just think of this as number concentration. It's not really important at this point. But what I want to show you is that in the atmosphere, this is in the atmosphere, this is what we observe, there are three distinct modes. Okay, three. There are different modes because of the sources and sinks. So we have condensation from vapor to form the first mode, which is a lot of times Aiken mode or gas particle conversion that makes it. So a lot of times it's called the Aiken mode, Aiken nuclei mode is probably the most common term for that. Then we have the second mold where the aerosols congregate. They stick together, they form bigger particles. And this is what we call the accumulation mold, because this is the mold that accumulates the most in the atmosphere. This is the long rib mold that occurs. These ones form from vapors, so you can have a lot of radiation, a lot of sunlight that can affect this. These are the ones that are occur for the day's sphere. And then the final one is what we call the dust mold, or coarse particle mold. And then, of course, there's different ones. There's coarse mold and fine particles, too, that we that people use, particularly satellite remote sensors who use that terminology. But there's a coarse mold, which is mechanically generated, which I give you the couple examples here, sea spray being the most prevalent if we're next to the ocean. See how the sea, salt from breaking waves. What would we get a lot of dust mold particles around North Dakota? Maybe not this time of year, but in a couple months, how would we get a lot of these type? During the harvest, but I'm thinking more of just you're out in the country, you're driving around, what would generate some dust? Just driving down the gravel road. So all that dust that you get kicked up, that's in this size mold. Okay, these ones are out fast. However, it's only places like desert regions, arid regions, that you get a lot of this. So when you make measurements in North Dakota, you almost never see this mold present. And then these dividing lines between the molds are usually always there, but they're not always at the same point. So a lot of times the aerosols get more aged, and this mold will move higher. Also, this one will be more aged, and it will move higher. The important one I want to look at is that is precipitation. It's the formation of clouds and removal by precipitation. So what do you think would happen after you have, you know, one day it's sunny, we get a storm come through, we get some rain, and then the next day it's a post-frontal environment. Which one of them two would have the higher aerosols? Just thinking about the sinks. Pondi, I guess you, I haven't asked you yet. Before the rain would have higher or lower? So it would have higher and then we'd have some washout for that. So it's always when you do this, you look at the two processes together that will determine it. And also the other important things, like when I talked about at my first slide, where I showed a nice stable atmosphere, what would be the other thing besides just the removal and the sources of the aerosol that would be important? There's one. Maybe I haven't. It goes back to where do the aerosols come from? You know, I gave you some of these sources, like sea salt. What location in the atmosphere would this be the source? I'm talking vertically, or so sea level. Obviously, it's next sea level. Dust would be next to sea level. A lot of gas particle conversions would also be near the boundary layer because a lot of gases will come from the surface. So the sources are typically in the boundary layer or at the surface. So this is a hint now. What's the third thing that would tell you about the concentration? Yeah, so your atmospheric stability, which would determine how much it mixes, how high that is mixed up through the atmosphere. And this goes back to how long we have atmosphere. You get big convective storms, it would kick it up higher and get transported up higher. Okay, one more interesting fact is I said these are aerosols are solid or liquid particles. And this one's kind of technical, but I think it's so important for understanding atmospheric aerosols and CCN, is to know when are they solid and when are they liquid. And what do we mean by liquid? So let's take sea salt. Sea salt is, I have it on here, sodium chloride. Okay, this is the same stuff we put on our food, fluoride. So it is, can be a crystal, has a crystalline structure. It's a solid periodic structure. That's what we have on when you have the salt. But is this the way it is in the atmosphere? Well, the answer is yes and no, because we can have an aqueous phase of these particles. So just like when you had your chemistry classes, you took and you dissolved salt in water. I hope everybody's done this, or sugar in water. We all do this every day, right? So on these vertical particles that are 1 micron in size, they can have the same thing. It can be a solution. Okay, it can be a dissolved salt, and you can actually have the ions. So if you got sodium chloride, what are the two ions in sodium chloride? Go back to your chemistry. Okay, no volunteers. I'm going to keep calling on people. So you should answer the questions you know, or else you're going to get called on for the ones you don't. What are two ions in sodium chloride? Erica? Yeah. Well, it's hard because you got to remember back to that high school chemistry when there was small back. So here's a hint, this formula, NaCl. So, and then there's two of them. Huh? Well, it's sodium, Na is the symbol for sodium, and chloride is a Cl. And the ions, because the Na will be positively charged and the Cl will be negative. So it's one positive, one negative, they stick together and form an ionic bond. Okay? When they're in solution, they're actually ions and they're separated. Okay? So that's what occurs in these particles. They're actually dissolved salts. And that's very interesting because you can have sometimes one or the other. So when do we know about this? Is we look at what the relative humidity is in the atmosphere. This is the atmospheric relative humidity. And something really magical happens, or impressive, or whatever the term is that depending on the salt, there's a particular relative humidity where it goes from a solid, and then it starts to absorb all the water, and it turns into a solute, and its size goes up. It can double in size just by changing a little bit in relative humidity. Okay? And then it will increase in size as the relative humidity goes up. So it can double or more in size, and then if the particles will be one, and then if they're at 90%, they can be 3 or 4 times as large in terms of its relative volume. So what does this matter in the atmosphere? Remember hazy days at the ocean when it's you got that haze there that you see these particles, they're so big. So it's not only the size that matters, but when you see them and scatter, it's the volume, and they can have a lot of water associated with them. The other magical thing or interesting thing is after they become solutions, they do not go down the same point. I call it a deliquescence point or deliquescence RH. But if you come down this way and your humidity goes lower in the atmosphere, they will not go down and get to this deliquescence point and just dry out. It will take them to a considerably lower RH before they return to the crystalline state. So the size, the amount of water associated with the aerosols depends on the history of the air mass they're in. Okay? So when you measure these and you talk about their size, you know, it's important to know the relative humidity. So this is a prelude to a little bit of crowd physics where you get in core diagrams. I'm not going to go into this. But we basically have a size. They initially start out one size. At a magical size, they go up, and they change in size at the Dirac quiescence point. Okay, and then they follow this curve up and grow in size until they get to 100% relative humidity. Okay, what I really want to look at is this part of the curve is where we form the crowd droplets. Okay, this becomes the activation point of the crowd droplets. And so when they come up, we get above 100% relative humidity. So yesterday when I talked about CCN measurements, I said we're making them at 0.6% supersaturation. So saturation is 100%, and typically a lot of times you only get 100.4% relative humidity in the crowds. At most we get about 100.6. So it's hard to say 100.6, so we say 0.6% supersaturation. So once they get this, hit their point where they become activated, then they'll grow to larger drops and get crowd particles, crowd droplets for that. And then likewise, when they return back down, this is the curve. They do not follow the same path when they dry out. So, remember. So questions. This is a little bit of a confusing diagram. The lines here are because of the initial starting point of the aerosols. This is like 0.06 micrometers. This is 1.7. So a typical CCN would be, let's see, this is 0.7, 0.06. So point one, the CCNs will start in this size range and go up. So I'll tell you what particles will activate and which ones won't. But you'll see also here that the larger particles will need a lower supersaturation to activate. So if you have that distribution that I showed before, okay. So here we go back to, if you can remember what I said. So remember, I had the accumulation mode. Okay. We had the accumulation mode particles where this is the radius. This is increasing. So if I have a particle that's this size and one that's here, and they go up into which one would activate at a lower supersaturation? Which one activate at a lower supersaturation? The star or the triangle? How many people say the triangle? So everybody must think it's a star. Yeah, it's the larger particles that will activate first. Okay. And the Dirac quiescence point changes for different salts. Ammonium sulfate, which is a very prevalent aerosol particle, is a little bit less. But they all have a Dirac quiescence point and an efflorescence point. So, oh, we got a question in the back. Oh, to begin with?
Yeah, they're all.
Okay, they will. So we go back to this one. So this is a distribution of all types of particles. So there's a whole bunch. This shows you the corrections of all these particles. So if you're in the gas phase here, it would be condensing more gas onto the particles. Right, for example, you have sulfur dioxide gas. It gets released in burning sulfur fuels in a volcanic eruption. You get a high concentration of sulfuric SO2 gas. Okay, you get some particles initially formed, you have this excess, that gas particles will hit the aerosol and they will grow in this gas phase by condensation. Okay, also it helps to have sunlight. If you have a lot of OH molecules, they can have reactions that occur and the molecules will get bigger on them. So You can change the composition. You can grow the particles by condensation. The other one is they can stick together. They'll bounce and connect together, kind of similar to coalescence and clouds. Okay, so if they last in the atmosphere longer, they're going to get bigger. So we can measure this peak here, and it tells us something about the age of the aerosols. So if they're fresh, you see this at smaller sizes, and this phase will actually grow during the day. You can actually watch this move during the day. This one will take longer, but if it's more aged particles, the peak will be larger. So a lot of times I'll look and see where this peak is. Right now it's pretty much at, let's see, it's 0.1. So it's pretty high. A lot of times, I gotta get my units right on this. Yeah, one. This one's 0.1. A lot of times it's over this pair. A lot of times this will be at like 20 nanometers around here. I got some plots at the end that show that. So this is a pretty aged spectrum. So they're all together. So when I represent this, this is a distribution of all the particles. And they will change. Other questions?
Which one of these particles?
Which ones would be aqueous, which one crystals? Depends on the relative humidity. All can be one or the other. You can have ammonia sulfate particles, even from the gas phase. If you have ammonia, which is a prevalent near surface source, biological sources give you a lot of ammonia, and then you got sulfate from SO2 gases, they will condense and they will form either a crystal or an aqueous phase, depending on which other gas molecules are available. If it's high relative humidity, they will do it in the aqueous phase. If it's low, it's not. Even in the dusty places, typically we think of dust as being dry because it's usually in a dry environment. But you can have this in terms of ocean waves, and they will be humidified. And as a side note for maybe some of the more experienced people in here, this is important when we make measurements in the atmosphere, because if you make in situ measurements with an instrument, we bring it into an instrument and we inherently dry the particles. And we don't know, and so we can measure at different varying humidities, and the size we would measure is different. So what we typically do is we dry the particles and we measure them in a crystalline state. However, people that use remote sensing from satellites, when you use like an optical depth from a satellite, they're in the relative humidity that's in the atmosphere. And they don't measure it at a dry crystalline state. They would be measuring the aqueous phase. And so when we compare them, we have to be able to take our measurements that we make and actually go back and increase the size and then calculate. So that's one reason I pointed out the importance of this. It's also important for when you see the scattering, like if you go in a national park or something, a lot of times it's really hazy. It'll be a lot hazy on high humidity days compared to low ones, even though the aerosol concentration can be the same. Yeah, typically, I mean, if we measure them, I got some plots at the end that we actually measured them. If you actually are measuring it, it is a dried out version because it's very difficult. Okay, I was just say this is, it's impossible to measure them in situ without having some, because we hit them with razors. We bring them to the instrument, we bring them inside. We're going to be changing the relative humidity of the air. And it's impossible really not to do that. So, you know, but you can go from one to the other, and there's actually instruments that would measure how much it changes with humidity. So we'll measure that increase, and not just for sodium chloride, but for anything that's in the atmosphere. And so you can obviously take a dry one, and then you can calculate out what it would be wet. So that would be one thing, like if we use a PCAS instrument to measure aerosols on the aircraft, that's a dry particle. And if we actually want to compare it to an optical depth, From a satellite sensor, from AeroNet, we would have to humidify the particles. Okay, so now onward to the favorite thing of CCN counters. We want to measure these CCN that are very small. And we, if you saw before, they can be 50 nanometers in size. And the wavelength of light is 500 nanometers. We want typically like to measure with lasers. Okay, they give us a good scattering. But if we put a 50 nanometer particle in a laser that's 600 nanometers, a red laser, it will not scatter enough light to be detected. So the secret is we have to grow the particles. And we do this by creating a supersaturated environment. Okay, so we create an environment like a cloud. So we take the undetectable particle, put it in a supersaturated environment, and grow it to a detectable size, basically a cloud droplet. That's 3 to 10 microns or 3 to 12 microns in size. Now, these are big enough to scatter light, and then we can detect them. We can see them. So for every CCN we have, we get one cloud droplet, and only one. And so we count these and infer back these instruments. And we do this in what's called a diffusion chamber. We're diffusing water vapor onto the particles. So we're growing the particles by diffusing the water onto them. This is an example of the technique that we use in the a horizontal static thermal gradient diffusion chamber instrument. We create a supersaturated environment inside the chamber. We have an inlet and an exit. Bring the air into the instrument, into this chamber. Close off both of the inlet and the exit. And we change temperature of the bottom plate. So we put a temperature gradient between these two plates. So keep this at ambient conditions, say 20 degrees Celsius. Put this at 16 degrees Celsius. It'll create a supersaturated environment inside the middle of this chamber. And the droplets will then have to grow. Any CCN in there will have to grow to cloud droplets that we. And so we want to determine number of particles. So what an illustration of this, okay, is let's take 297 Kelvin. Let's talk in absolute temperatures here. Everybody hopefully know the conversion between Celsius and Kelvin. Okay. Yes, okay. 273. The bottom plate is 5 degrees difference at 293. And the temperature distribution in the chamber, the diffusion of temperature and the diffusion of water vapor are different. And so we get a supersaturation in the middle of the chamber that goes from 100% at the bottom and top to something like 101% in the middle. Here, they activate, grow, and then we can detect them with a laser. Question. And this is pretty small. It's about 10 millimeters, sorry, 1 centimeter, to do this. And I don't want to go into the details of how this happens, but we detect them in the middle of this supersaturated environment. So one of the difficulties with this type of technique, can you guess what it would be? Okay, how long does it take? So if we form a, that's a good question. Let's know, how long do you think it takes for, let's say a droplet, an aerosol particle to activate in here? Timber. And I give you a hint. Here's, it's 1 centimeter high. Okay. This is a still environment. They will activate and grow. So how long do you think it would take? And again, let's be orders of magnitude. Seconds is a good time unit. So, 10th of a second, 1 second, 10 seconds, 100 seconds, 1,000 seconds. Anybody volunteering? Come on, someone has. Okay, we just keep. When I say the number, raise your hand.
I got a question for
Bob. Okay. The time it takes the particles to start at, let's say, 50 nanometers, okay, and grow to 5 microns. Okay, so the particles, they will enter this chamber, all right, they come in here. They enter the chamber, okay, and we start detecting them and we close off the chamber. So how long, and again, I guess the other question is, it depends on the supersaturation. So let's say, let's pick 0.6% supersaturation, because it does depend on the supersaturation. Or even less, 0.5, something like that, 0.5, 0.6. I only got to be in within a factor of 10 here. So 0.5% supersaturation grows from 50 nanometers to 5 microns. Okay, now raise your hand when I say the time interval. Okay, remember it goes from 0.1 seconds to 1,000 seconds. Okay, 1,000 seconds is like 15 minutes. Okay, so 0.1. 1 second. Okay, we've got 10 seconds. 100 seconds. 1,000 seconds. Okay. I think everybody had it right at 10 seconds. So it does take 10 seconds. Actually, what we do in this is our detection time it takes is actually 20 seconds that we will measure for. There's 10 seconds, there's a total of 30 seconds, 5 seconds to flush the chamber, and then 5 seconds to make sure we have the right correct temperature. But we'll measure for 20 seconds to measure supersaturations between like 0.1% and 1%. So, and the higher the supersaturations, the faster they will grow. So other questions? Dropper. They won't clump together in the chamber because they all fall nice and gently. There's no turbulence to mix them. There's nothing to collide with to cause any collision. There's no turbulence in the stator. That's why it's called a static chamber. There's no flow. It's sealed off, and they just form wherever they are in there, and then they won't clump together, at least in the middle of the chamber. There's not enough time. The coalescence will take a lot longer, and you have to have something to form. So in that 10 seconds, it's not enough time for two of them to grow and then to collide, because they take all the water around them. But the aerosols will move around too. I mean, it's a lot easier for the aerosols to move than it is for the crowd droplets. Back on my question.
What happens if the aerosol comes in really close to the top plate or the bottom plate, where the saturation is really small? It doesn't grow
anymore. No. What we do is we actually count just in the middle of the chamber. We actually just count in this supersaturated environment. So we don't count the whole thing up here. We just count in the actually this thin layer right here, right where the maximum supersaturation is. So they can change and stuff. And we actually measure for that time period, but we look at the peak when we have the most particles. And what we figure is that this whole chamber has the same concentration of the aerosols. So if we measure here, in this one motor area, it's going to be the same in this whole chamber. Because when it came in, we mixed up the air, and we have one sample in there, and it's uniformly distributed. It takes about 30 seconds to make a measurement. So what's the problem type of design? Anybody see any problems? If you're going to design an instrument. Well, one problem is it takes 30 seconds. We wouldn't want to measure faster. The other problem is that the air got to be static in this chamber. So they've developed new counters, particularly the one that uses a vertical diffusion chamber, where the air flows vertically and doesn't stop. So basically, you take the horizontal one and you turn it vertically, and you have a continuous flow of air through there. All right, and again, you change the temperature between the top and bottom, and you get a super saturation again just in the middle of the chamber. And then we put a detector at the bottom. So that way you can detect faster in terms of detecting them continuously every second, because they're continuously flowing, the air can continuously come in. The problem is it actually takes a lot longer to change the temperature in this instrument than the other one. So to go between supersaturations and the other one, it takes like 2 minutes to do three supersaturations. This one would take 10 minutes because you've got a lot more mass on the walls to change. Okay, the thing is, what we actually measure is the number concentration, so number of particles per volume, and usually a cubic centimeter. So my other favorite question is, how big is a cubic centimeter? So here's my dice. How many cubic centimeters in here? Oh, about one. It's actually about three, but a bit more than one. So that gives you an idea of how much it is. So you get an idea of the volume that we measure. That's the unit we use to count the CCN over. And so what are typical values in the atmosphere? So of course, I like to put some of my measurements up here. We did measurements in the low atmosphere in the winter. I get 150 in Wyoming. It depends on the area. Wyoming in the summer, about 400 or 500. Did some measurements in New Zealand, up to 1,000. West Africa, we got about 400. These are at 0.6% ambient supersaturations. We can look at other people's measurements in the literature, different places. Most of Australia, 120. And of course, this goes up to the highest, 3 to 5,000 in Texas, which I would assume that these are more highly polluted environments. So, the range is about from 100 to, 3, 4,000 per cubic centimeter. Where do you think the cleanest place on the planet would be in terms of aerosols? Told you cities and places with a lot of dust would be very polluted. Go to a bar or something with a lot of smoke. But where would be the cleanest place? Arctic, yeah. You go to the South Pole, you can get down to 5 or 10. But you never get actually zero. Unless you put a filter and you filter. You can remove all the aerosols, and actually the rooms are pretty clean because they remove the aerosols from most rooms that we live in. So the way we make these measurements, we can do them like we did on top of Crifford Hall last summer, make some of these measurements and sample at the surface. That's what a lot of these measurements are doing. If we're interested in what goes into the clouds, we put a CCN counter on an aircraft and draw in the air to the counter. Also, we draw it into, we had both CCN counters we can put on the aircraft, the desk size, so we can put them on there. We want to sample the outside air. Couple important things when we do these, you got to do these correctly. We want to be measuring the outside air, so obviously we don't want any leaks in the instruments, which can be a big problem. We have to have that chamber enclosed so it doesn't leak. Kind of obvious, but it's easy to get leaks. The other thing is we want to use proper tubing. We always use conductive tubing so the aerosols don't impinge on the walls. They flow through the tube and get into our instrument. So we want the instrument to be coupled to the environment. Go out, make a bunch of flights, and take a bunch of measurements. Do flights around North Dakota. And this is the plot I showed yesterday. I wanted to make sure that you understood it in terms of the distributions. So these are the ones that we measure in North Dakota. Now, would you consider this high, low, medium? Because now I gave you some background of what other people have measured. What do you think these measurements we make at Cloud Base in North Dakota? Are they on the low side, medium, high? Don't want to answer. Matt got some opinion. Yeah, medium. I think they're a little bit on the high side in terms of continental clouds. You know, the 3,000 to 4,000 is very crude environments type of stuff. These are probably on the higher side of any place that we'll get in the continent. And rest you're in a city like Mexico City or Los Angeles, but they're pretty high for, you know, our rural environment here. They're also pretty high considering that the overall aerosol mass, that people measure aerosol mass for health regions, we are never exceed that. We don't have a lot of mass, but we typically have a lot of number of aerosols. And we measure them for 30 seconds, so we take that measurement in, come up with one measurement, and then put these all together to get a distribution of all the measurements that we make so we can spray them at one time. And so which one of these plots is not normally distributed? If you had to say which one of these plots was the most non-normally distributed in terms of the data. Okay, Matt cannot answer this question. Okay, who do I get to pick on now? How about the second row there? Between Mario and Matt. Come on, you two, get together. Tell me which answer it is. Which one's not normally distributed? The third one. So the mean and the median are not the same. The other ones are pretty close, and also the box and whiskers are the same. So a lot of times in aerosols, there's a tail, particularly in terms of the size distribution. So that's why we put in this type of distribution plot. And of course, I could show you another one for different years. And I will end at one more point, and that is the vertical distribution of these plots. I usually said that the source is near the surface. So here's our surface. Here's our cloud base. These are some CCN measurements made in West Africa. And in this case, you can actually see a very distinct layer here. So you can have elevated layers from smoke and stuff transported. However, most of the cases are similar to what we measured here on July 8th. Where we have measurements that are the same. Each one of these are the measurements. As we go up, they're basically the same as what we get up here. So they get well mixed up vertically. So, of course, when you get above the boundary layer and above the cloud decks, they will mix different heights. So, any questions on that? I got through just about everything. So, Matt got one more. We have some measurements in terms of from one season to another. I mean, we got 3 seasons of CCN measurements. I think my one of these plots will show it. This one is in 2008. So we made a bunch of measurements in 2008, 2010, and 2012. We get measurements, you know, on a handful of days for the season. How representative are they? What we need to do is more long-term measurements, and that's what we did last summer. We had continuous measurements with the CCN counter, with the DMT counter. That way we can make continuous measurements over a long period. So we started in June, and we measured until October. And this weekend, I'm going to analyze that data more thoroughly and see how it changes, at least over that short time period. I say, you know, to me it's long, but in terms of looking at change that you saw, it is long. The best answer I can give you would be from other measurements, particularly ones made by NOAA, where they haven't measured long-term CCN measurements. They've started that in Oklahoma, but they measured optical properties, basically accumulation mode aerosols. So they've looked at that, and I've actually published stuff on the long-term trends where we looked at 10, 15 years of measurements. And we looked at, we had continuous measurements every minute for 10 years. We did this in Illinois, for example, outside of Urbana-Champaign. And I looked at them measurements, and there's no significant trend in terms of time, which is can be good or bad. But again, 10 years may not be that long. And again, to really see a statistical change, it would not have to be that long. So I would not expect that we would have something over a 10-year period that would change. So over 10 years, I don't think it changes. The bigger question is, what was it 200 years ago or 300 years ago? You know, was the concentration, we're up here about 1,200, or was it down more about 200, 300? Okay, that is what we really don't know. Another way to answer that question might be is how many of these aerosols would be anthropogenic? How many of these CCN would be anthropogenic? And so I don't think we can go back and make measurements 200 years ago. We'll get a proxy for that, but it'd be easier to figure out what percentage of these are anthropogenic. And for that, the easiest way you look at it, the easiest way would be looking at the chemical composition and also try to trace it back in models. So. Actually, they're actually the same. The 1% is the theoretical value in the instrument. So the 1% is what you would get if you use theory. Okay, if you use theory from diffusional gas theory, and you took the temperature at the bottom and the temperature at the top, and you figure out what the supersaturation was in the temperature. So if you put this 5 degrees temperature difference, you should theoretically get 1%. However, there's instrumental problems. And the actual real supersaturation in there is not 1%. It's more like 0.6%. And we know that from using COA theory and putting in aerosols and seeing when they activate. So testing the instrument will give us more of a 0.6% supersaturation. So that's really what the instrument's given. The same problem with the DMT counter. We have to set it for one supersaturation, which is one that we set the instrument at, but that is not really what is in the instrument. The software they sell you would tell you this is the supersaturation. It is not the case. So we have to calibrate that out.
During the ARM meeting, I heard a lot of people talking about 0.2%.
It depends on the crowds. In marine environments, in continental ones, the 0.6% is the highest you get, is the maximum that you would expect here in continental crowds. I would expect that the true values of these crowds are more like 0.4 to 0.5, 0.4 probably. And then if you got more, you know, less forcing on them, we do see, you know, the supersaturation is hard to know, but we can actually do that with a Crozier experiment and get it. But the ones that we've done, 0.4. The other problem is the instruments are a lot harder to measure at 0.1 or 0.2%. And so that's the reason why I take 0.6, because it's the easiest, most valid measurement, although it may not be the most representative one. So, Everybody left. Get to next class, so. Okay. Did you guys learn anything?
So, I have to say that your workbook is...
Yeah, I have that plot. I asked Nicole, and we did make a plot of all the years.
Okay.
And she's given it to me, so I will send you a link or send you the figures.
Okay.
Next week fine, or do you need it?
Yeah, next week is fine. It's yeah. Or it's a proposal. It's due. So is I want...
The other ones I have is I have measurements for my Wyoming Bruin ones, where we actually did Bruin profiles, which are right nicer.
No, I just want to use a or citation.
Yeah.
The
well, these are not from the citation, because this is from the aircraft we use at Fargo. It's in North Dakota, and but. Yeah. See, I'm actually borrowing these counters from other people. So UND, we do not own actually one of these counters. So I've used four of them because I borrowed them from NCAR, from WMI, and other people. We have to borrow them.
No matter what, if we show the people ready to do some measurements,
we know how to do it. We know how to do it. That's no question about that. So, and I the other ones I can show too is we have the DMT counters, but the problem with them ones is the vertical profile is not as good because what I did in them ones was we changed the supersaturation.
Right.
Okay. So you got your question of, you know, which supersaturation is, and well, we don't really know. So what I've done in the other one, because I had two counters, was that I would have one that would continuously change the supersaturation, but that would give us, it takes 10 minutes then to make three supersaturation measurements. And so when we're making profiles, you don't get any profile measurements because you get one supersaturation here, one up there, and it doesn't tell you anything.
You mentioned we can got a two CCN counter.
Well, see, the other problem what I'm working on right now is I use two different types of counters. So the other question is, how well do both of the counters agree? So I'm trying to calibrate the two to see how well they agree. So when you make the measurements, you have to decide, do you want the spectrum or do you want it at one value? And so if you take it at one value, then you can get stuff like vertical distributions very well. You can get fast changes in the CCN. But if you're staying at crowd base, you know, the crowd base measurements I showed, they don't change that much. So then I can measure a spectrum, and then I can tell you the CCN concentration at any supersaturation.
I think most we want to see how the CCN change from surface to cloud base. That's basically the vertical profile for CCN or marine.
And so in that case, then you want to do a continuous measurement at one supersaturation.
Right.
So, and that's the other thing is with the DMT counters, they can do it a lot faster because they can make that measurement at one second intervals as opposed to 30 seconds with the Wyoming ones.